One of the great black Rottweilers appeared from around the garage corner. Valentine reached into his feed bag and placed a few strips of meat on the flat of his parang. The dog took a few steps closer. Valentine stayed very still, offering the meat from the brush at the edge of the woods.
Good dog. Good dog.
Valentine lowered the blade to the grass. Flanagan obviously used the dogs only for show. A real guard dog would be trained not to take food from anyone but its keeper. Having made friends, Valentine stood for a moment, patting the hopeful-looking dog. Valentine watched the sleeping house for a few moments, then jogged across the lawn to the back door. The Rottweiler trotted along happily. The second hound, curled up on the mat at the door, fast asleep, startled at their approach. Seeing the other dog, it came forward to greet the late-night visitor. Valentine issued more tidbits to the dogs and began feeling along the top of the windowsill to the left of the door for the key Frat said was hidden there. He found it, placed on a small nail hammered into the top of the windowsill. The key fit the deadbolt on the back door, but Valentine was able to open the door only an inch or two. A heavy chain across the inside of the door barred further progress. He reached into his bag of tricks for the rusty crowbar from the patrol car's trunk, fixed it to the chain near its mounting on the door jamb, and pulled. Valentine entered the kitchen behind the business end of the shotgun. The tabletop was a mess of dirty dishes and paperwork. The main light over the table was still on, bathing the littered octagonal surface in a puddle of yellow. A heavy electric typewriter sat before a chair, a cold mug of coffee next to it, nestled like a small brown pond in a forest of empty beer bottles. He looked at the typed report on the table, flipping to the second page. Apparently, it was a statement by the one patroller standing sentry outside Touchette's VIP suite door at the New Universal Church building. A paragraph caught Valentine's eye.
When the cook entered with Mr. Touchette's nightcap of coffee, I heard him scream. I drew my gun and entered the bedroom. Mr. Touchette was face down on the bed, nude except for a pair of socks. The young woman was trying to force up the window of the bedroom, not knowing that it was nailed shut. As I entered, she smashed it with an ashtray, but I was able to restrain her. After she was handcuffed and held down by the cook, I examined Mr. Touchette for a pulse. He was dead. He had a steak knife handle sticking out of the back of his head right where the neck meets the skull. His back was coated with some kind of oil and he lay on a towel. There was very little blood on the towel. Mr. Touchette's brass ring had been removed from his finger and was placed around the handle of the knife. The young woman was screaming obscenities at us, so I hit her. She had not been injured by Mr. Touchette. The bruise on her face was from me.
Valentine walked to the living room and looked in. Virgil Ames lay stretched out on a leather sofa, sunglasses finally off, pistol belt looped around his arm. The air around him smelled of beer breath and stale flatulence. Beyond, in the glass turret room, he could make out Major Michael Flanagan. The major slept in his chair, phone in his lap, widespread feet propped up on his desk. The prowling wolf shifted the shotgun to his left hand and took up the parang.
No making friends with this dog.
Valentine put the wedge-shaped point just above Virgil's Adam's apple. At the swift inward thrust, the late Virgil Ames opened his eyes. Valentine wiped his knife on the rich leather sofa and moved toward the office.
Wait, what?
Major Flanagan woke when the blue steel of the shotgun barrel poked him between the eyes. As Flanagan sputtered into surprised wakefulness, Valentine changed the angle of the shotgun barrel, pointing it between Flanagan's outstretched legs.
You wanted to see me, Major?
What the hell? Virgil!
Dead, sir. Better speak up or you'll be joining him in 5 seconds. Tell me, is Molly Carlson still alive?
Virgil!
Valentine stuck the shotgun toward Flanagan's screaming mouth.
Major, your screaming is not doing you any good and it's giving me a headache, so cut it out. Or I might cut your tongue out and have you write down your answers.
Fuck you, St. Croix! We don't just have Molly. We got all the Carlsons as of 11 this evening. If you back out of here and never let me see your face again, they might live. You might even live.
The powerful spear-like thrust of the shotgun shattered two incisors and left a worm tail of lip dangling as it hung from a thin strip of bleeding skin. The major's hands flew to his wounded mouth. And Valentine clipped him on the side of the head with the shotgun butt. The major fell over, knocked senseless. Valentine busied himself with handcuffs and rope. The house was dark when Major Flanagan came to. Valentine splashed cold coffee into his face. His paroxysm showed how securely he was tied into his office chair. Handcuffs fixed his wrists against the arms of the chair, and heavy lengths of rope cocooned his chest and shoulders into the back. His legs were tucked under the chair and secured by ankle shackles, with a short length of chain winding behind the central column that attached the chair itself to the little circle of wheels below. No hint of morning could be seen through the windows of the office. Valentine stood next to the desk, a breathing shadow. Valentine picked up the silver cigar lighter, waving the lit end hypnotically in front of Flanagan's face. Its dim red glow reflected off piggish, angry eyes.
Okay, Uncle Mike. Do you want to talk to me, or do I have to use this thing?
Talk about what?
Where Molly is.
She's in the order building in Monroe.
Valentine grabbed his pinky and thrust the cigar lighter over it. Valentine pulled away the lighter and stuck it back into its electric socket, pushing it down to turn it back on.
Wrong answer. I read some of the papers in the kitchen. According to your report, you put her in a car for Chicago. Why Chicago, Major?
We called the Illinois 11 as soon as it happened. That's what they told us to do. Send her to Chicago.
Where in Chicago?
Valentine extracted the lighter.
How should I know? The Illinois 11 don't like being questioned any more than the Madison Courians.
Flanagan was watching the lighter wave back and forth in the darkness.
No, God, St. Croix, I don't know.
This last was addressed to the approach of the lighter to his left hand. Valentine forced Flanagan's fist open and inserted his index finger into the cigar lighter. Valentine withdrew the lighter. He pressed it back into the socket, reheating it.
The pain will stop as soon as you tell me where she is in Chicago. You want me to stick your dick in this next?
The tip of Flanagan's forefinger was a blackened lump of flesh and blisters. Even the fingernail was burned back. Flanagan saw Valentine's hand move to pick up the lighter.
I think they're putting her in the zoo. I've been there. It's on the north side of Chicago, near the lake. Lots of boats tied up permanent.
Why there? I thought they just put everyone in the loop when they wanted to do away with them.
They knew too shit. They asked me if she was a real looker. I told them about her. I mean, if she weren't my niece, one of the patrollers would have raped her a long time ago. St. Croix, you haven't been around much. I risked my job, my life even, to help my sister and her family. Molly was never gonna be hurt.
Sweat coated Flanagan's face, wetting his bushy eyebrows and running down his neck in rivulets.
So what's this zoo?
It's in a place called Lincoln Park. I got a little map of Chicago in my desk bottom drawer. He even has phone numbers for cab companies. The zoo is a big brothel, that kind of thing. There are a lot of bars there. They do sports, too. Kind of a wild place. Anything goes, like old Vegas.
Valentine popped up the lighter and left it resting lightly in its socket.
Good enough, Flanagan. There's one more thing I want before I go. I need a travel warrant made out for one Private Pillow, giving him a week's leave, or whatever you call it, to go to Chicago. And some money to spend.
Flanagan's massive eyebrows rose in surprise.
Well, Madison papers, no good there. Our guys bring things to barter, jewelry, beer, food, stuff like that. But what you're thinking is nuts. I'd like to see Molly alive as much as her parents, but it ain't gonna happen. There are hundreds of soldiers from Illinois, Indiana, Michigan even. I've heard of officers coming all the way from Iowa and Minnesota to go to the zoo. Even if you can find her, you'll never get her out. The black hole's a one-way...
Black hole?
I don't know where she would go for sure, but the black hole is kind of a prison. Women don't last long there. They're used, treated badly. Some of the men like that kind of thing. Never went there myself, but you hear stories.
Just tell me where to find the papers to fill out.
Flanagan gave detailed instructions, and soon Valentine had his travel warrant. The major applied his seal and signed it. Valentine had freed the man's uninjured right hand to do so. The major wiped his face with his good hand.
Oh, you're tough, St. Croix. I had no idea.
So, he thinks fawning is his ticket to safety. Interesting. Has it gotten him out of jams with the Kurians? Valentine thought. He put his new papers and the folded map in one of the front pockets of his shirt. He then walked over to the front of the desk. The shotgun leaned up against one of the carved wooden lions.
Well, take my car. It's in the garage. The keys are in my breast pocket here. I'll tell them you went north. I'll keep the Carlsons under lock and key for a few days, then release them. We'll shout questions at them for a few hours. Don't worry. They'll be fine. Of course, Molly can't ever come back here, but I'm sure you can get her somewhere safe up in the woods, if your plan works. Watch yourself in Chicago, though. Must be 100 Reapers there, easy. But if...
The Major stopped in open-mouthed amazement as Valentine brought up the shotgun, pointing it at his head.
What? No, St. Croix, be fair! I gave you everything!
Valentine put the butt tightly to his shoulder and placed his finger on the trigger.
You once said that if it were up to you, you'd hand me over to the Reapers for not having a work card. Well, now that it's up to me, I'm gonna follow a little rule we have in the Wolves. I call it Special Order 12, Section Double Aught. Any high-rank Quislings bearing arms against their fellow man shall suffer death by firing squad.
You said you wouldn't kill me!
Flanagan held out his hand, palm outward.
I said the pain would stop.
Valentine went through the house, filling a pillowcase with anything of value he could find. Virgil Ames' sunglasses and beaded pistol belt, Flanagan's cheroots and electric lighter, a solid silver cigarette box, gold jewelry belonging to the missing Mrs. Flanagan. The liquor cabinet contained two bottles of bonded whiskey. They joined the other contents of the pillowcase. He went into the furnished basement and flicked on one of the electric lights. A pool table filled one end and a small workshop the other. Three rifles hung from an ornate gun rack set between 2 8-point deer heads. Valentine's eyes lit on an old Remington Model 700. He shouldered it. Then he crossed to the workshop and found a tin of kerosene. He opened it and splashed it along the pool table, carpet, and wood paneling. He struck a match and tossed it into the puddling liquid on the pool table. Flames began to race across the green baize surface. Sure that the fire was well on its way, Valentine climbed back up the stairs. Pratt pulled the car out of the field and onto the little path leading back to the road.
Now what, Lieutenant?
Oddly enough, Pratt had asked no questions about what had transpired in his uncle's house.
Where can I catch the next train to Chicago? Not a station, though. I mean to jump on.
Pratt considered the problem.
The line connecting Dubuque goes right through Monroe. A train goes along that every day. Takes you right into Chicago, or the meatpacking plant, that is. You'd be in the city by tonight. You'll know you're close when you go through this big stretch of burned-out houses. Reapers burned out a huge belt around the city. Great Suburban Fire, it was called. Happened before I was born. Then they did something to the soil, so nothing but some weeds grow. Mile after mile of old street and rubble. Of course, I was pretty young when I saw it. But you'll never find Molly in the loop. You could look for days. How are you gonna get her out again?
They didn't put her in the loop. She's in some place called the zoo.
Pratt smacked his head.
Zot me! I should have thought of that. They would put someone who looks like her there. My mama used to tell my older sister, what are you trying to do, get a job at the zoo? Whenever she didn't like what Phila was wearing.
What else can you tell me about Chicago?
Pratt turned the car onto a road heading south.
It's big, really big. But what you got going for you is there's a lot of people from all over, so strangers don't get noticed. If you cause any trouble, they grab you and throw you in the loop. They use the old United States money there, too, but it has to be authorized. The bills they've authorized have a stamp on them, kind of like a stamp on our work cards. I'm pretty sure some of your people who fight the Kurians are there, but I don't know how you would ever find them. And I'd hide that big curved knife of yours. Too many of the soldiers know about those.
They reached a bend in the road. Pratt pulled the patrol car to the side.
Pratt, you've been a great help. You know what to do now, right?
Drive fast with all the lights on, like I'm hurrying somewhere. Put the car in a ravine and then walk to that bridge. Go cross country and keep out of sight. I think I can manage.
I'm sure you can.
All you have to do now is go south, and you'll hit the railroad tracks. They curve where they run along the Sugar River, and I bet they'll slow down. Lots of guys bum rides. As long as you got identity papers, you're okay getting into Chicago. Just take my advice and don't cause any trouble until you are sure you can get away with it. Getting out again isn't so easy. They check the trains heading out for runners.
Valentine offered his hand, and Frat shook it.
Listen to Gonzo on the way back, pup. You can learn a lot from him.
Yeah, he's cool. He thinks a lot of you, by the way. Says the wolves in Zulu Company call you the ghost.
The what?
The ghost. On account of you walk so smooth and quiet, like you're floating. And there's another reason. Mr. Gonzalez says you can tell when there are vampires around. He says it's spooky, but kind of comforting.
The ghost, huh? Well, have Gonzo tell them to keep their rifles clean and oiled, or I'll come back and haunt them. Goodbye, Frat.
Goodbye, Lieutenant Valentine. Don't worry, I'll get everyone out if Mr. Gonzalez just points a direction. You ain't the only one good at smelling out skulls.
While Valentine waited for the train in the morning shade beneath a willow, he ate from a bag of crackers and a brick of cheese he had taken from Flanagan's kitchen. He had already improvised a shoulder strap for his pillowcase of loot and admired the manufacturing on the stolen Remington rifle. He figured it would bring enough money for a bribe or two, or serve as one itself. He studied his map of Chicago, memorizing as many of the street names as he could. It must be quite a city, he thought. Over 100 Reapers. Great place to visit, but I wouldn't want to die there. Chicago, October of the 43rd year of the Kurian Order. The second city is still a town on the take. A resident 20th century Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist once suggested that the motto for the city should be, "Where's mine?" Nowhere is the art of bribery, corruption, and widespread beak-wetting more common than in the Kurian-controlled, Quisling-run city of Big Shoulders. No one is even sure exactly how many Kurian lords run the city, as the Kurians divide it not by geography, but by business and property ownership. A Kurian lord might control a steelworks in Gary, an automobile parts plant on the west side, several apartment buildings on the Gold Coast, and a few antiquated airplanes that fly out of O'Hare. His Reaper avatars will travel among holdings, going into the loop for regular feedings. To prevent the Reapers from taking too much of an area's vital labor force, the loop system was developed after 20 years of fractious and chaotic rule. The Kurians had little use for the high-rise business centers of the downtown, and after emptying the assorted museums and stores of anything they fancied, they created the walled enclave as a dumping ground for undesirables. Here, the Reapers could feed without worrying about taking a vital technician or mechanic and starting a series of inter-Kurian vendettas that might escalate into a full-scale feud. The workers of Chicago enjoy a security that few other communities under the Kurians know. But their existence depends on paying their way in old federal greenbacks. The destitute receive a quick trip into the loop. But the elite Quislings who run the city for the Kurians amass sizable fortunes in a variety of barely legitimate ways. One might wonder what the point of wealth is with the Kurians in control, but the Kurians have become infected with the virus-like corruption that seems to thrive in Chicago and are often bought off by their ostensible slaves. The top Quislings use their money to bribe the Kurians not with cash, but with vital auras, the one thing the vampiric Kurians prize above all else. The Quislings buy captives from a soulless body of men and women called the Headhunters, who in turn buy them from wandering bounty hunters who lurk on the fringes of the Kurian territory, grabbing everyone they can. These latter-day fur trappers pick up strays in a circle moving clockwise down from northern Michigan, across southern Indiana and Illinois, and then up the eastern shores of the Mississippi to the northern woods of Wisconsin. When a wealthy Quisling has turned over enough vital aura to the Kurians, a brass ring is awarded. Only in Chicago is the practice of buying brass rings allowed. With the security of cash and a brass ring, these robber baron Quislings then retire to Ringland Parks, a 20-mile stretch of stately homes along the shore of Lake Michigan, just to the north of Chicago, the only large area of suburbs to survive the flames that desolated Greater Chicagoland. But as brass rings cannot be passed down to sons and daughters, their progeny are left with the tiresome task of doing it all over again. Chicago has become what Vegas was to the pre-Kurian world, an anything-goes city where anything, including human life, can be bought or sold if the price is right. The Chicago skyline looked to Valentine like the bones of a Titanic animal carcass. His position atop the freight train gave him an unobstructed view as the train bore southeast, straight as an arrow in flight, toward the city. He would have felt naked and defenseless riding the rocking platform, clattering across the uneven points on the rail line, but for the companions scattered across the last few boxcars. Now and then, other hitchers made the run and vault onto the line of cars. He first spotted the skyline in the blackened ring of former suburbia that encircled the city like a burned-out belt. It reminded him of a picture of the town center of Hiroshima after the atomic bomb. Nothing but rubble and cracked pavement. He wondered what the currents had done to the ground to poison the plant life. Dry-looking brown weeds and the occasional withered sapling grew from the bare patches of soil. He wondered why the currents wanted to create this vista of desolation. He asked an Illinoisan, a 30-ish man who had hopped on as the train left the hills north of Rockford.
What, a Chicago blight?
The man looked at the expanse as if seeing it for the first time.
You got me, brother. My brother's in the Eye Guard, and he says it's a no-man's land between the Chicago Currians and the Illinois 11. They depend on each other, but they had a big fight back when I was just 5 or 6. Anyway, the blight makes them refrain from wandering out of their territory to feed. Then I got a sister-in-law in Chicago, and she says it's to make getting out of Chicago harder. Guess burning everything was easier than building a wall that would have to run 50 or 60 miles. But I've still heard of a few people managing to run across it in daylight. If they get lucky and dodge the security service and make it out by nightfall, I've heard of people escaping Chicago just using their legs. A lot of time they run right back, though. It's more dangerous downstate. I've been trying to get a good paying job in Chicago for years, but I don't have the toque for a good position.
You don't have the toque? What's that?
You must be on your first trip to Chicago, Blue Boy. A toque is like a tip, but it's more of a bribe. Money's the best, but it's got to be their authorized stuff. You try to palm off a bill you picked up in Peoria and you're asking to get your face smashed in. Cigarettes are good toques, too. And if you're doing anything major, like getting a cab ride or checking into a hotel, you toque twice. Once when you arrange it, and again when you're done. If the first one is too small, it might blow you off and look for someone else. If the second one's too small, they'll just swear at you. But you'd better not expect any more favors. I've seen fistfights over too small a toque at the end of a cab ride, so be careful. But getting back to my point, for me to get a decent factory job, I'd have to toque the doorman, the union boss, and the manager. Maybe a couple of managers. And those would be big toques in the thousands. Hard to scrape up that kind of money on a farm.
Valentine reached into his bag and extracted one of the major's cheroots. He handed it to his fellow traveler.
Thanks for the tip.
Hey, you catch on fast. Hey, listen, if you want, you can come with me when we get off. I know a good route out of the railroad yard. That's a fine rifle. And some Chicago Security Service officer is going to quote regulations and take it off you if you go through channels. Unless you can cough up about $100 worth of toque, that is.
You're a pal. My name's Pillow.
Norbu Oshima. Most of the guys just call me Norby. Pleased to meet you, Pillow.
My friends call me Dave, but it's my middle name.
They made small talk as the city grew steadily larger. At last, the train pulled into a bustling rail yard, spread out over several square miles and dominated by a thick concrete tower. The train eventually switched to a siding near a series of livestock pens. Produce trucks and horse-drawn carts waited nearby, ready to accept the contents of the boxcars as the shipping clerks sorted them.
Come on, do the cattle crushes. There's a storm drain to the Halsted Bridge.
Other figures were hopping off the train and scattering, pursued by a few police in navy blue uniforms. A corpulent CSS cop jumped out after them from between two cars. But Valentine and his guide vaulted over a series of fences as they ran across the pens, and their pursuer gave up after mounting the first two bars.
Fucking yokels! Where's my toque, you bastards?
They rolled under a chain-link fence and slid into the concrete drainpipe, dragging their bags after them.
Welcome to Chicago.
Looks like he lets his uniform do his fighting for him.
Yeah. Those CSS guys got him made. Everybody tokes him. He's had one too many free burgers and beers at the Steak and Bun. Speaking of which, I'm starved. After I drop my stuff at my sister's, you want to eat?
Thanks, but I gotta find someone. You know where I can find a bunch of bars in a row called the Club's Flush? On Rush Street, I think.
You must have some good barter in that sack. Those are some nice places. Never been in them myself. They take up a whole block. Rush is easy to find. It runs at an angle to the rest of the streets. Watch yourself around the vacant lots. I'll get you to Division Street and point you in the right direction.
Thanks.
He handed Oshima two more cheroots.
Don't worry, David. You'll do fine. As long as those cigars hold out, anyway.
Valentine walked down the street consulting his tourist map. Even in the afternoon, there were more people on the street than Valentine was used to seeing in the most populated parts of the Free Territory. Despite the people, he felt strangely alone. The city smelled noxious. A mixture of tar and garbage assaulted his nostrils. Sewage odors wafted up from the storm drains, and trash overflowed from dumpsters in the alleys. Public sanitation was not a priority with the Cur.
Hey, Blue Boy! You want a ride?
Nearby, a man in a straw hat stood in front of a carriage. A horse stood patiently in harness.
Take you to the zoo. Got a friend at one of the entrances. Let you in for half price. Your buddies in Wisconsin won't believe their ears when you get back.
Maybe later.
Cats seemed to be everywhere, especially in the rubble of the empty blocks. Hungry-looking stray dogs prowled the alleys, sniffing the gutters. Valentine spotted the Club's Flush. Had it been night, he would have seen it from farther off. Electric lights on the building illuminated a 10-foot mural of a hand holding four kings and a joker. In sight of his goal, Valentine realized how tired he was. His last night in bed had been interrupted by Molly's visit, and he had been active ever since. He unbuttoned his shirt and smelled his chest. Molly's rosebud soap scent still clung to his skin. The memories gave him new strength, even as he considered the hopeless task ahead of him. How could he have imagined a city this size? He reached the bars, but there seemed to be no way to get inside. Nor could he see through the dark-tinted glass windows to get a hint of what waited within. He passed a woman wearing a dirty smock, standing out of the wind and smoking a cigarette.
Entrance is around the side. I work there, 3 to 11 shift. Good luck getting past wide load. You looking for a job?
No, just a little fun. Thanks.
Hey, check it out.
She removed a brown paper-wrapped package from under her smock.
16-ounce porterhouse right out of the Diamond's cooler. $12, what do you say?
No, I'm fine for food.
$8. You can't do better. You can sell it for at least 20 on Michigan Avenue.
Valentine turned the corner and found the entrance. It was a decorated alley with a brick arch above, wide enough to allow a wagon inside. Red and black painted wooden double doors with the club's hours stenciled on showed that it must still be before 6, as they were closed and locked. A smaller door was fitted into the right side of the gate. A face that would not encourage casual conversation scowled out from a crack in the door.
What?
You wide load? I want to see the Duke if he's in.
Not for you, Hick. Beat it.
I'm forgetting my manners.
Valentine reached inside his pack. Looking at the fleshy face, he opted to hand over the brick of cheese he had snacked on earlier.
Yeah, that's more like it.
Wide load opened the door and engulfed the 3-pound brick in a paw that resembled a gorilla hand ashtray. Valentine watched Wide Load as he sampled the Wisconsin Dairy Gold. Both of the wolf's legs would have fitted in the man's shirt sleeve, and he and Gonzalez could have slept out of the rain in his trousers.
Not bad, Blue Boy. Go up the spiral staircase. There are two doors at the top. One's marked office. Go in the other one.
Valentine nodded and entered the courtyard. Plants sprouting through a mulch of cigarette butts decorated the brick-paved enclosure. Beautiful brass and glass doors, one facing in each direction, indicated the locations of the four bars. Each was named for a suit of cards. Curious, Valentine looked in each door. The one marked spades seemed to be devoted to gambling. The kidney-shaped green baize tables could mean little else, and brightly lit slot machines filled the walls. The diamonds bar looked like a dining room. Valentine had heard about, but never before seen, white tablecloths, polished silver, and flowered centerpieces. All were in opulent abundance inside the restaurant. The club's room was the only one open for business. Comfortable leather chairs lay scattered around next to small tables, and the bar appeared as devoted to cigars and pipe tobacco as to alcohol. A few men, some even wearing suits and ties, lounged around, reading newspapers or playing cards. Most were smoking. The Hearts Bar looked like a glitzy brothel. It was the largest, taking up 2 stories, and had an open space in the center that featured the traditional stripper's pole mounted on a circular stage. Valentine counted 3 bars within the mirror-decorated main room. Valentine shrugged to the cheese-eating doorman and climbed the metal spiral staircase. He went to the unmarked door.
It's open!
A familiar female voice sang out. He entered and recognized the Duke's escort sitting behind a desk larger than the one in Flanagan's office, but somehow more delicate and feminine in its rich glossy sheen. Debbie? No, Dixie? Valentine's mind cast about for her name. Denise, of the revealing décolletage dress, he remembered. Today, she was wearing a simple gray sleeveless outfit.
Hi, Denise. Can I see the Duke?
She looked up at him, puzzled.
Does he know you?
Sort of. We met at the bunker in Madison. He said to drop by if I was ever in Chicago. David Tiny, remember?
Oh, that's it. I thought I saw you before. You're the guy with the nice hair. The Duke says some wild stuff after a few drinks, but you might be able to see him for a minute before we, he goes to dinner. Hey, you wouldn't have an extra toot of that happy dust, would you?
I'll see what I can do later.
Oh, great. Thanks. If you want to sit, there's a couple of chairs. He's meeting with a guy who brings in the drinks and eats. They've been at it all afternoon, so they should be done soon.
She favored him with a smile. Valentine offered Denise a cigarette. Her smile widened, and she tucked it away in her desk. He sat, trying to stay alert. Faint, muffled voices came from the inner office behind a door painted with a king of clubs. Trust someone with the Duke's taste in clothes and women to carry an idea too far. Needing something to occupy his mind to prevent himself from dozing off, Valentine hardened his ears and listened to the voices inside the office.
I'll tell you a tale, Duke. The whole Currian system would work better if they just formed a new order bank or something that had a currency that was good everywhere. This business of shuttling around boxcars full of people is just ludicrous.
All I've got is a 200-pound male. Can I get a 100-pound woman and a 50-pound kid as change?
Okay, I'm exaggerating again. It's a little better organized than that. It's one thing for the Currians here to send a few boxcars full of people up to Milwaukee and then bring the cars back here loaded with beer. But let's say I want to buy beef in Texas. If it's hot, some of the currency is going to drop dead on the trip. Plus, you get the local reapers in Tennessee and Point South looking to take some people off here in exchange for riding the rails.
Well, you got to look at it from their point of view. Money doesn't mean much to them. Some of them like art and stuff, but auras are the only recognized currency. They're like a bunch of damn junkies.
Yeah, you're right. But it still makes me nuts. Plus, the people know what's coming at the other end of the ride, which makes them tough to control. And finding good men to do the work of keeping them in line ain't easy. Most of the ambitious ones were in the military. Leaves me with the idiots and thugs who just want to push people around.
I hear that. Listen, if the side meet is a little late, we're okay. I'll just do a special on pork chops or something. But you got to get home to those pretty wives of yours, and my stomach is growling. Call me tomorrow and let me know if you've made any progress.
They said their goodbyes, and the man, richly dressed in a matched set of pinstriped pants and a vest, walked out and waved at Denise. She picked up the telephone and pressed a button.
Hi, big guy. Can you see someone really fast? It's that sailor with the black hair, David Tiny. No, we met him in Wisconsin last month. Yeah, at the buy. I don't know. He said he might have some later. Okay.
She got up and opened the door.
You can go in, Dave.
The Duke, who seemed to draw his fashion inspiration from Elvis Presley, wore a white silk jumpsuit with the 4 suits of cards printed as racing stripes going down his arms and the seams of his pants, which were tucked into white leather boots. His office was all business, save for a rug made out of a polar bear, its snarling mouth pointed at the door. The Duke was putting away papers and clearing his desk. Valentine noticed a gleaming revolver in easy reach used as a paperweight.
Well, Dave Tiny, right? Didn't expect to see you so soon. I heard a boat from the fleet was in, but it wasn't yours. What are you doing in Wisconsin Blues? You jump ship?
Bullseye. There was some bad blood with the captain. I'm searching for fairer horizons.
Valentine reached into his bag and pulled out one of the bottles of bonded whiskey.
Here you go, Mr. Duke. Little token of my esteem. Thanks for the great party that night at the bunker.
Hey, thanks, Tiny. You're two flavors of all right. So you're seeking a new opportunity. Ambitious fellow. Good for you. Hey, you wouldn't have another load of that high blue, would you?
Sorry, sir. But if I did, you'd get it.
All of it, Valentine thought. Wonder how you'd look after swallowing a pound of cocaine. The Duke seemed to lose interest.
Too bad. So you gave up life on the waves and are toting a gun in Wisconsin. Any other plans?
Just a brass ring.
Well, I wish you luck. Here's a card. You can get an evening's drinks at any of my clubs. And here's a backstage pass for the Hearts Room. You're good looking. One of the girls might take a shine to you. You'll find they're a lot more fun than those would-be dykes on that ship. Have Denise endorse it on your way out, would you?
The Duke put his hand significantly on the phone.
Sir, I'm new in town. I got some barter I want to turn into cash. Where won't I get ripped off?
The Duke's interest returned.
Sure, buddy. I can give you an opinion on that. What you got?
Valentine placed the contents of his sack, save for his parang and Virgil Ames pistol belt, on the Duke's desk, finishing by laying the Remington carefully on top. The Duke picked up the gun and worked the action.
Not bad, Dave. How'd you come up with this stuff after only a month in uniform?
Same way as I got the pass to come down here for 3 days. I did my captain a big favor.
A favor? What kind of favor?
I promise not to say.
The Duke smiled and flicked the side of his nose with a finger.
I get it. I bet you took out the captain's rival. Or did the colonel get shot by insurgents and the captain take his place?
You're warm, but I can't tell you, sir. Sorry.
The Duke examined the rest of the loot. He plugged in the silver cigar lighter and worked it.
Hey, that's aces. Look nice down in the club room. Tell you what, since you're an old friend and all, I'll buy it all off you. Make it $3,000 plus free drinks in the Hearts Room while you're on your pass. This your first trip to Chicago? You can have a lot of fun on $3,000.
Yes, it is, Mr. Duke, but I think I can do better on Michigan Avenue.
Hold on, son. Okay, $5,000. And I wish I could do better, but jewelry just isn't worth what it used to be.
Mr. Duke, some patrollers told me about the zoo. What's that?
The zoo, huh? I guess your balls are working again after that kick you took. Well, the zoo is the place for you, then. It's pricey, but it's a blast. Every night is anything-goes night. Ever seen a grog fuck a woman? They got one there with a dick like your forearm. Hey, Tiny, tell you what, just to seal the deal, how about I give you a 3-day pass to the zoo? Save you $1,000 right there.
Valentine reached into his pocket and pulled out the mirrored sunglasses.
You do that and give me a place to crash while I'm in town, and I'll throw these in.
Let me see those.
Valentine passed the shades over, and the Duke looked at the wire-thin frame.
These are 20th century, maybe.
He gently flexed a bow.
Hell, real titanium. Okay, Dave, you got your place to sleep. Have Denise set you up in one of the rooms above the club room. There's even a shower down the hall. You can get yourself all squeaky clean for your night at the zoo.
And my $5,000.
Coming. Gotta hit the old bank.
The Duke walked across his office to the rear and swung a velvet painting of a grinning jester's face away from the wall. A gray, formidable-looking safe sat in the wall behind. The Duke spun the combination and opened the door, which was layered with multiple panels of steel. He extracted a pad of bills with a thick rubber band around it and walked over, handing it to Valentine.
5,000, my friend. Pleasure doing business with you.
Valentine pulled up the first bill and flipped through the others.
Hey, most of these aren't authorized.
The Duke slapped him on the shoulder.
Oh, good eye, Dave. Good eye. I knew you were sharp. That was just a test to see what kind of an edge your mental blade has. Here, give me that back. I'll get you the real stuff.
The Duke wandered over to a decorative roulette table stacked with bottles of fine liquor. He spun the wheel to a point Valentine could not determine and pulled up the spinner. He reached into the space beneath the wheel and took out a sheaf of bills. He hurriedly counted.
Okay, all this is authorized, Dave. Scout's honor. But spend it all. That stamp's good only for a couple more weeks. Then you gotta stand in line for a new issue. Counterfeiters make it tough on us hard-working smugglers.
Valentine checked again, seeing the red circle with cryptic squiggles stamped over the face of Ben Franklin on each bill. he picked up the now almost empty sack.
Thanks, Duke. I want my first trip to Chicago to be a memorable one.
Don't mention it. If you decide to move here, I might be able to connect you to a job for, say, 15% out of your first year's paychecks. I could even need a favor myself someday. You might be able to help me with that, and I'd be able to give you a hell of a lot more in return than your captain or whatever he is. And Chicago beats the hell out of living up in Cheeseland.
It's my kind of town.
Valentine arranged for his room with Denise. The room was small and clean and had a mattress to die for. Valentine inspected the late Virgil Ames pistol again. It was an old Army Colt automatic, firing the powerful .45 caliber ACP cartridge. It wouldn't necessarily stop a Reaper, but it would give it something to think about. The gun belt also held four spare magazines, all of which were full. With the ammunition in the gun, that gave him 35 rounds. More than enough, as he did not want to use the weapon except as a last resort. Valentine stretched out on the bed and forced himself to sleep for 2 hours. He showered and put the gun belt and his knife back in his pillowcase sack. He ate downstairs in the club room. The food was simple, satisfying, and overpriced. He paid $25 for an overloaded sandwich and a pot of tea. He looked at an employee working on a case that held smoking paraphernalia and had a thought. Valentine smiled at the server behind the counter.
Excuse me, sir. You have any waterproof matches?
He means the big matches in the tins.
The man who spoke was arranging cigars in the display case. Valentine noticed a tattoo with a dagger stuck through a skull on his arm.
It worked good even in the rain.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. I'm outside a lot, and it's a bitch to light a cigar in wet weather.
Here's what you want.
The cigar man put a circular tin in front of Valentine. Valentine unscrewed the lid and extracted a 3-inch match. The entire thing was lightly coated with a waxy substance. Valentine struck one on the strip at the side of the tin, and it flared into a white light. He could feel the heat on his face.
That's magnesium. It'll get a cigar going in any wind unless your tobacco is soaked, of course.
Hey, thanks. Can't find these in Wisconsin. How much for a tin?
I ain't cheap. $50 for a tin of 10 matches.
If I buy 5 tins, will you give them to me for $200?
Sure. Seeing as you're a friend of the man upstairs.
Done.
Valentine toked the man the other 50.
You must not get to Chicago often.
No, there's a lot of things here you can't get in Wisconsin. Like the zoo.
The tattooed man looked wistful.
Oh, yeah. I can't afford to go there often. Once in a while, I buy a cheap pass off the Duke.
Ever been to the Black Hole?
Oh, sure. I've checked it out a couple of times. I got a strong stomach for that kind of thing. I mean, some of it even turned me on.
Do they ever let regular guys get at the girls, or is it just shows?
Oh, now, if you got a couple of thou in cash, they got these rooms in the basement, soundproofed, you know. You can do anything you want. Anything. After all, the women and men in the Black Hole, well, they're the people that the Kerr decided deserved something worse than the loop.
You don't know anyone who works there, do you?
Oh, no. Sorry. Wish I did. But you seem to know how to toke. Just get the money in the right hands. You'll be fine.
Valentine paid for his matches and took his leave of the eatery. He approached Wideload, still on duty, blocking the door like a parked dump truck.
Leaving? Fun starts soon.
Wideload stepped aside to open the door after a glance outside. Valentine squeezed past the human obstacle and entered the street. He walked out of the alley, turned, and walked in the direction of Lake Michigan. A black van, its windows reinforced with wire, stood on the curb in front of him. The initials CSS and a small logo were stenciled in white on its side. The Chicago Security Service? Two grubby youths, leaning on a corner, stubbed out their half-smoked cigarettes. A silent siren went off in Valentine's head. Tobacco in Chicago wouldn't be wasted by street punks. He heard footsteps behind him. For a moment, his body betrayed him. His legs turned to bags of water. When the handle on the back door of the CSS van turned, he knew the trap was being sprung. Two massive arms enveloped him. Wide Load locked his hands in a deadly variation of the Heimlich maneuver, but instead of pushing up into his diaphragm, he pulled Valentine to him in a rib-squeezing embrace. A second pair of men approached from across the street. One, tall and thin, wearing a red tank top and a pair of chainmail gloves, removed a pair of familiar sunglasses as he ran toward Wide Load and his victim. Valentine brought his booted heel down hard on his captor's instep. He thrust back his head, and the bear hug ceased. The four men closing on him were trying to trap him between the club's flush wall and the CSS van. Its rusty back door swung open. Valentine lashed out with his foot, kicking the door closed again. It shut on something, fingers or a foot.
Shit, look out!
Valentine ran across the street, accidentally spilling a pair of riders on bicycles as they turned on their rubberless wheels to avoid him. The four pursuers tried to triangulate in on him, but he called on his speed and his legs answered. He cornered around a parked horse wagon so fast his feet skidded on the pavement, but he maintained his balance just. With open sidewalk ahead of him, he broke into a loping run. A few loungers on doorsteps stared as he passed. He chanced a glance over his shoulder. The four were sprinting to catch him. 30 seconds passed, and the four became three. In another minute, the three were two. By the time Valentine turned a corner, running up a series of short, cluttered blocks, the two had become one. The tall man with the chainmail gloves. His red tank top was dark with sweat. Valentine turned down an alley and found breath in his body to do one more sprint. He zigzagged around fetid mountains of refuse, scattering rats with his passage. His pursuer just managed to start down the alley as Valentine turned the corner at the other end. To the east down this street, he saw an end to the buildings.
It must be near the lakeshore and the zoo.
Valentine pressed himself up against the corner and listened to his pursuer's heavy breathing and heavier footsteps as he trotted up the alley. The man slowed as he approached the alley's exit. When he knew the man was about to come around the corner, Valentine lunged. He brought his knee up and caught his pursuer in the stomach. In no mood for a fair fight, Valentine grabbed his assailant by his hair and brought his knee up again. The wolf shuddered, still keyed up. He pulled the gloves from the unconscious man and added them to his sack of weapons, then trembled again, but for a different reason. A Reaper, coming and already so near. Valentine tried to clear his mind, make it as empty and transparent as a painless window. He stepped back into the shadows of the alley, moving away from the Reaper. At the other end, he dug himself into a pile of trash, burrowing on his knees and elbows into the filth. He felt cockroaches crunch and crawl as he joined them at the bottom of the sodden refuse pile. The alley grew colder.
Up, you! Up!
The Reaper seemed to be speaking in Valentine's ear. The wolf almost leaped to his feet, ready to fight and die, when he realized the voice was at the end of the alley with the Duke's thug.
Center. Center, I've got the center.
You, footling, where is the terrorist?
Motherfucker, the motherfucker jumped me. Speak clearly, will ya?
Who?
Oh my God!
Awake now!
No! Oh my God! Yes, sir! Yeah, I think he went toward the lake. That was where he was running, sorta.
You were supposed to follow him, not take him.
The Duke said...
The Duke isn't here, or he would be taken instead of you.
A motor at Valentine's end of the alley drowned out the Reaper's voice. He looked out from beneath his garbage and saw a gleaming red car stop. One of the punks who had dropped out of the foot race sat on the hood, directing it. Rats scattered again as the man jumped off and the passenger door opened. The cold spot on Valentine's mind, marking the Reaper, swelled and pulsed as it conducted the aura to its master vampire. All around the neighborhood, Valentine heard doors slamming and windows closing. From beneath a mass of flattened cardboard, Valentine watched the Duke, in all his gauche splendor, blanch as he looked down the alley. The Duke gulped and slunk into the alley toward the scene. His henchmen trailed him for two steps, then thought better of it and returned to the car. The Duke rubbed the brass ring on his finger. Valentine wondered if he sought comfort in its touch, or perhaps imagined what having his finger pulled off would feel like. The wolf read mortal fear in the Duke's eyes before he passed. He let his ears take over, afraid to shift his position. The Reaper had senses other than that which allowed it to read auras.
The good Duke. 8 years with a brass ring, courtesy of his aura-drunk lord. Dealer of powder-white chemical joy. Harborer of terrorists.
How was I to know, sir?
You are ready to do business first and ask questions, not at all. You have tap-danced close to the edge of the law too many times. Others in the Order are beginning to take notice. Like this fiasco. My instructions were not clear.
I just thought...
You're kept alive to do, not think.
Well, why should that damn renegade get my money anyway, sir? He's up to no good. Throw him in the clink and be done with him.
That damn renegade is something special. One of my clan sensed him coming into the train yard. We want to know who he is going to meet, what they know, and what they plan. His kind do not just wander into town to look around. He's one of that breed our foe kin use for their dirty work. Clean up this mess and return to your club. We will take over the search.
He said he was going to the zoo.
A cover story, or perhaps...
What shall I do with my man?
Throw the corpse to the snappers. I go now to find what you have lost. I felt his aura hot and clear for a moment as he fought with your man. I can find him again.
The chilling spot in Valentine's mind moved away. He waited while the Duke had another henchman carry the corpse to his trunk. By the time they left the alley, it had grown dark.
Vampire Earth is continued on the next CD.
Valentine emerged from underneath the garbage and left the alley. He concentrated on keeping life sign down, casting about for somewhere to get some clean clothes. He found a used leather goods store and purchased 4 cheap belts and a long leather trench coat that was missing some buttons. He put the black coat on after paying for it. In an alley, he put on the gun belt and the parang and filled his pockets with the tins of matches. He tucked a belt up his left sleeve and rolled the others up and put them in his pants pocket. His remaining cash lay folded in his breast pocket next to his identity papers and a small white card.
Well, I'm as ready for the zoo as I'll ever be. Pray God the zoo isn't ready for me.
The Zoo. Lincoln Park, a green oasis between the shores of Lake Michigan and the shattered city, is considered the premier entertainment tract of Chicago, and indeed the Midwest. From what had been the oldest zoo in the United States at the south to the Elks Temple in the north, Lincoln Park, as run by the Currians, is a mixture of Sodom and Mardi Gras. Along with its adjacent gambling ship tied up at the old Chicago Yacht Club in Belmont Harbor, it offers diversions to suit the most jaded palate. From late March to November, Carnival is in session. This non-stop party provides much-needed relief for the favored Quislings who are allowed to attend. During Chicago's dreary winters, the action is limited to the indoors, but remains just as wild. With good behavior, a Midwestern Quisling can expect a trip into Chicago to visit the zoo every few years. They are released in groups, and anywhere from 2 to 100 go to Chicago together, with the direst warnings about what will happen to the rest should any desert. Parties from places as far away as Canada, Ohio, and even Colorado and Kansas visit for up to a month. But as the money runs out to the point that even shoes are sold to pay for unholy delights, The trips are ended early by mutual consent. Everyone knows the destination for those left penniless in a city where there is no such thing as a free meal or room. Within the confines of the zoo, there is no curfew as there is everywhere else in the city. There is ample, if poor quality, food and drink to be had at any hour from street vendors, tented cantinas, and permanent restaurants. Mounted officers, equipped like the statue of Phil Sheridan with sword and pistol, patrol the area from their headquarters in the old Chicago Historical Society building. They do very little to break up disturbances, and only a fistfight that threatens to grow into a riot will cause them to do anything but pause and sit their horses to watch. Everyone from magicians to three-card Monte operators to street musicians try to make a living on the streets. But nothing can be sold on the grounds of the park, save food, drink, tobacco, drugs, and flesh. It is this last that is the real attraction of the zoo. Under every lamppost, at every corner, and inside every barroom, women, a few men, and the occasional child can be found for a price. At the top of the carnal hierarchy are the showgirls, performing everything from strip teases in the clubs on Clark to variegated sexual displays behind the bars of the zoo that would make those performed in pre-Curry in Bangkok seem tame. Next come the geishas. These women, found in some of the better bars, act as short-term girlfriends to the Quislings on vacation who want more than just sex, providing a sympathetic ear as well as other favors. The full-time companionship of a geisha for a week or two is out of the price range for all but the wealthiest Quislings, but bar girls in the saloons will do the same as long as the soldier keeps buying them watery drinks. Finally, there are the colorful streetwalkers in a variety of flavors, offering their services anywhere from alley and bush to the little flotilla of old boats anchored in the park's Lake Michigan-fed waterways. The careers of the zoo women are short, and most come to a sad end in the loop. A few make enough money to retire to Ringland or open an establishment of their own. A few more leave the zoo permanently in the company of a Quisling. But for most, it is a degrading road that leads to servicing the most perverted and violent customers before the final trip downtown. As for the Quislings, like carnivorous flowers attracting insects with bright color and perfume, only to trap and devour them within, the wanton joys of the zoo leave many too broke to get home, and unless they are smart or lucky, they become prime candidates for the loop. The night breeze no longer blew just cool, but downright cold. Scattered clouds crossed the full moon like inky stains. Below, the color had drained from Chicago's streets, leaving a world of low contrast black and white. As Valentine drew farther away from Rush Street, the streetlights became irregular, and those that still functioned gave light to a few square yards around the pole. Scattered figures clutched their coats or thrust hands deep into their pockets, shoulders hunched against the wind as they brushed past Valentine without a word or a glance. Beater cars and small trucks chugged along the streets, most without benefit of headlights, as clattering bicycles dodged out of their way. Valentine could hear the clopping sounds of hoofbeats on pavement down a nearby alley. He cast about with his nose. The city seemed overwhelmed by an oily petroleum smell and dusty coal smoke. The gutters reeked of urine. Valentine glanced up again at the moon. Its chalky whiteness comforted him somehow. Full moon. Good night for a wolf. But a sudden wave of fear passed through him, leaving his back running with cold sweat and his hair bristling. He paused under a light, ostensibly to check his map, when motion ahead caught his eye. Pedestrians parted like a school of fish swerving to avoid a cruising shark. A reaper, garbed in a shirt, trousers, boots, and a cape, rather than the usual robes, moved toward the dead heart of the city. It ran with great multi-yard leaps, like a deer bounding through the woods. Valentine's hand fell instinctively toward his gun, but he managed to change the gesture into a simple thrust of his fist into his coat pocket. The reaper passed without a glance in his direction, its sickly yellow eyes blazing like tiny light bulbs. Valentine turned and watched it go. It reached the back of a slow-moving car, a ramshackle vehicle with wood planks where the panels and roof used to be. The hood leaped over it in a single bound, cape flapping like bat wings in the night. and disappeared out of sight. Somewhere to the east, Valentine could hear Lake Michigan lapping at its breakwaters. He sensed lights and music somewhere to the north, a mass of noise that could only mean the zoo. To either side of him, ruined blocks of rubble sprouted shanties like wooden toadstools. Some buildings still stood and showed signs of irregular maintenance. Everything from glass to iron bars to wooden shutters covered the windows, and the smells of cooking wafted out into the street. Valentine could make out trees in the lights ahead, and now several figures had joined him in moving toward the zoo. Most of them had brightly colored cards dangling from thin beaded chains around their necks. He noticed a line at a kiosk on the edge of the park and joined the cluster of waiting men, almost all of whom wore assorted uniforms. An elephantine red-headed woman sold the white cards on chains to the lined-up men under the supervision of a cigar-smoking baldy with the watchful, sullen air of a pit boss. Valentine looked at the prices, which started at $500 a day. He extracted the pass he'd obtained from the Duke and passed it to the meaty hand of the redhead.
3-day pass, huh, boy?
She reached under her counter for a card on a chain.
You one of the Duke's couriers?
Sort of. What do I get with the pass?
She did not really smile so much as smirk, but her eyes favored his with a friendly twinkle.
About anything your heart desires.
She peeled a covering off the paper and began to recite the rules.
This card will stay green for 72 hours. That's guaranteed. When it turns red, you gotta leave the premises. While it's green, you can see any show, go in any bar, and get free coffee or iced tea on the Lady Luck of the Lake if you're playing. And that's the gambling boat. Real plush carpets, and more lights than you've seen at once in your whole life, I'll bet.
Hey, there's people waiting.
Shut your trap, you, or I'll start reading to him out of the 22 yellow pages.
She turned her attention back to Valentine, drawing close enough for him to smell the beer fumes on her breath.
You take my advice. Just spend your 3 days here. The food's cheaper than most anywhere in Chicago, and when you want to sleep, just pay one of the girls for an all-nighter. You get a woman and a bed for what you'd pay for a bed alone in one of them rip-off hotels.